ends for need. So our role in this process is quite specific, to review the specific proposal that's before us against specific questions that the legislature asks us to review. We just want to acknowledge at the outset that this is a very complex and dynamic market environment that we are in, which does raise some policy questions and considerations that we are very happy to comment on further in your hearing if that's of interest. Certainly the public interest review, by its very nature, it really aims to try to understand a forecast, and it is just that, a forecast of what any given proposal's impact on the larger community is. So it is not a commentary on simply the business case or the merits from the proposer's point of view on a given project, but rather what is the larger impact forecast to be on the community. With that, I would turn it over to Mr. Gildermeister to describe the review and the results in this case.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildermeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health. And it's a team of analysts in our program that over time have conducted public interest reviews. As Commissioner Malcolm noted, I'm going to provide a little context of what the public interest review is, talk briefly about the proposal itself as it presented itself to us, and then look at the findings with some evidence. And I will close with some final thoughts that the legislature may wish to consider.
We're having a little trouble hearing, and we're trying to get the microphones to work, but if you could speak up for the benefit of those of us at this end of the table. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I hope this is better. So the public interest review process, as Commissioner Malcolm noted, was in addition to the hospital moratorium law, intended to provide the legislature with objective information as it deliberates proposals for exception to the moratorium before them. So that process started in 2004 and has been employed six times by the Health Department since then. The way it typically works is that applicants submit a proposal to the Commissioner of Health. The Department of Health then has 90 days or up 6 months in extenuating circumstances to complete the review. We typically place a notice in the about the review in the state register to ensure that we can get diverse perspectives on the proposal. We also typically reach out to other hospitals to get their perspective on the proposal, typically with a letter from the commissioner or from our leadership. Our role, as Commissioner Malcolm has said, is to reach a finding whether a given proposal is in the public interest. Of course, the legislature retains the decision-making authority of whether or not to grant an exception. The statute requires us to consider all relevant factors before us in proposals to either establish a new hospital or to expand existing licensed bed capacity, but it also highlights five factors in particular that we are to consider. They include the extent to which a proposal would bring timely access to care or access to new and improved services, the financial impact of a proposal on existing hospitals, particular hospitals with emergency departments, the extent to which a proposal may affect staffing in the community, staffing of hospital beds, and then the extent to which an applicant would deliver or would continue to deliver services to non-paying or low-income patients in their primary service areas. And then ultimately, we're also to consider the views of affected parties. Typically, our process is we're looking to make sure that our process is quantitatively based, so that it's based on empirical information. We draw on data from a number of sources. We look at the literature to the extent that it offers theory or evidence on particular questions. And then, as I said, we look for input from other hospitals and the public concerning a particular proposal. And that's the process we've followed here as well. All information about a proposal is publicly available, and I've included a website here. But what you will find are not just materials about the current proposal, but also past proposals, as well as public feedback on those proposals. A quicker word on the region's hospital proposal, and this is a summary of a much larger and thorough document that regions submit to us. Again, it's on the website for those of you who want to look it up. But essentially, between November 2017 and March 2018, we received a series of information from Regents Hospital about their proposal. It's been a longer period because we had questions about some of the topic areas of the material that we received, sort of clarifying question, and we looked for additional data. Roughly speaking, the proposal adds about 100 beds to cover expected inpatient need through 2015. It's split across medical surge beds, mental health beds, and obstetric beds, as shown on this slide. A couple of points that Regions in its proposal emphasized. Number one, it demonstrated and showed data to show that the hospital is operating at near full capacity, which has the potential to affect care. It highlighted efforts already underway to reduce emergency department use and unnecessary admissions, sort of making the point that efficiencies or processes to increase efficiencies are already in place. The proposal makes the point that Regions expects market share to increase for all facilities, so Regions hospital does not expect only its boat to rise, but all boats to rise with changes in demographic trends, and concludes also that a number of the investments needed have already been made in the past, so that there would be somewhat of a limited amount of resources going to implement this proposal. I should say the exact cost of the proposal we were not able to identify that as part of our discussion with Regions Hospitals. This timeline shows the expected timeline that Regions would use to implement its growth strategy. In green, the addition of medical surge beds. In red, the addition of OB-related beds. And then in blue, the mental health beds to be added in 2025. Unless there are any questions, I'll move to the findings from our review. I should say, for those of you who were able to grab a package of information, we've submitted to this committee and the authors a letter that show our findings and an enclosure with more detailed information. The next slides are condense some of this information into a PowerPoint presentation for today's discussion. Our findings from this preliminary review has been that the Health Partners proposal in its current form to add 100 licensed beds to Regions Hospital in the next 22 years is not in the public interest. I want to pause here and add to this a point that I'm going to make further in a few moments. This finding does not suggest that there are not components of the proposal that could be in the public interest or suggest a need for capacity expansion at Regions Hospital. We've reached the conclusion that I've showed you here primarily based on three findings, and I'll go through those findings in the next few slides. Number one, we found that the proposal appears to make optimistic assumptions about future inpatient growth spanning about 30 years of expected demand at a time when there is considerable uncertainty about the shape of future hospital care. So I'd like to add to these points in the following way. Maybe by taking a step back and talking about how we conduct forecasts or projections, we more broadly, regions and others. Essentially, our expectation about the future is typically based on knowledge from the past. That is true for economic forecasts. That's true for forecasting insurance rates. That's true for demographic forecasts as well. The longer the time horizon, the greater the amount of uncertainty, and the greater the likelihood that structural patterns don't persist into the future, the more likely or the greater the error of the forecast. So our observation here is that the period of the forecast is really wide, which suggests a high possibility of imprecision of these estimates. So that would be one point. Typically, we found that the industry leaders in the work to forecast expansion at hospitals look at 5 or 10 years to limit the error of the forecasts. Yes, it's typically based on demographic trends, but then secondly, forecasts look to take into consideration change in technology, change in pharmacotherapies, change in policy environment, and ultimately also change in economic fortunes. From the onset, we think this proposal is bound to be associated with potentially large error in the forecast. We've done some of our own analysis and have found through whatever model you use, any model is highly sensitive to the assumptions to make. So to get this right is difficult in the first place. It's more difficult over a long period of time. Secondly, we've looked to replicate the method Regents Hospital used to forecast over a 30-year period by looking back in time and asking if we used that method in 2001, how close would we be to predict the actual hospital bed capacity in the community in Minnesota. And essentially the approach that Regents took, and I think in some ways it's a reasonable approach to recognize that we don't know the shape of about the future, what we know most about our demographic trends. But if we just limit our analysis to demographic trends and rates of hospitalization, static rates of hospitalizations, we found that the rate of hospitalizations for the elderly population, people 65 years or older, would have been heavily overestimated by about 60%, so much so that instead of bed need growing by 140 beds, it actually fell over this period by 125 beds. So this is not to say that analysts weren't careful, but rather to say this is complex work, and unless the forecast takes into consideration some of these factors that are more difficult to forecast, it likely will overestimate future bed need. I don't have a slide on this, but what we've been observing over time is, of course, a pretty significant reduction in the number of hospital admissions, hospital beds, available hospital beds, and also a number of bed days. The second point that has led us to our conclusion relates to what we find are expected negative financial outcomes or impacts on hospitals in the East Metro area. And again, I'll bring a little bit of evidence in a moment to you about that. But we essentially looked at two questions there. We asked, what's the likelihood that market share across all admissions stays stable the way Regents expected it to be, and will there be a change in the mix of services delivered by all hospitals in the East Metro area? And we find it very likely that neither of those points will persist. So let me say this again. We expect both the mix of services to change over time, favoring Regents Hospital, and as well the overall admissions to favor Regents Hospital for the following reasons. We've looked, so maybe to take a step back again here, profitability at hospitals are a complex undertaking, and I can't claim that we at the health departments are experts here. So in a simplified way, we've looked at the services that have the highest probability of producing profitability for a hospital. And those are major operating room procedures, so surgeries, essentially. And what we observed looking back just about 10 years is that the share of these procedures, again, that have a higher likelihood of profitability across all payers, have been increasing for Regent Hospital. So Regent has been commercially successful to attract these kind of services. Our expectation is with the proposal focused on shoring up services in cardiac and neurology care that this trend will persist and maybe picking up. I want to be clear in saying this is, of course, conjecture because we don't have any evidence on what actually will take place, but it is based on ordinary economic behavior of competing market participants that they would seek to maximize profits or for nonprofit organizations revenue in excess of expenses. Secondly, we think there's also a likelihood that Regent's market share off hospital inpatient admission will continue to grow over time. And there are really two dynamics here that seem to be at play for us. Number one, the vertical integration between health partners and regions, which enables itself to manage care differently from other institutions, also offers the ability to steer enrollees to a particular hospital. And that's not just a hypothetical opportunity or possibility. That's something that we have some data on. One graph here, focusing on the only area where we have actually reliable data, is derived from the individual and small group market, where we see that about 15% of policies have only one hospital in the network, and in this case, that is Regent's Hospital. Another graph that I could have shown that in some ways is maybe more interesting is to demonstrate that two-thirds of the health partners' policies limit hospital access to Regent's Hospital. So again, a reasonable commercial tactic to manage care, drive populations to a provider where care can be managed effectively, but ultimately one that is likely to favor Regent's Hospital over time. The third point that led us to the conclusion that we arrived at is that the proposal will end up making significant investments in the healthcare into the healthcare system within a marketplace where there is already excess capacity. So what do we mean by that? The moratorium exists because the legislature was concerned about excess capacity and the cost that comes with it. And the cost, I think, is twofold. Number one, there's pretty good evidence that the economic incentives under fee-for-service, which still governs much of the healthcare system in the U.S. and in Minnesota, despite really important efforts to change to value-based care. But fee-for-service still drives incentives to put patients into beds. So the more beds there are, the greater likelihood that patients will be hospitalized. And again, I'm happy to share the evidence with you or point you to the report that will include that in greater detail. Secondly, and I should have actually said that in response to my previous point, secondly, when hospital markets experience competition, actors in the market will sort of counter that. And again, that is typical market behavior in which hospitals try to shore up their own financial viability by making investments in service lines in competition with a hospital that develops a stronger footing that not necessarily are productive and might have not occurred had the level of competition not shifted. And secondly, by making investments in technology that otherwise might have not occurred. And that's not a hypothetical scenario either. I think for observers of the healthcare market, you will notice that every hospital in the metro area that and beyond that is delivering obstetric services, they have developed mother-baby centers to, of course, attract a share of the patient population to deliver babies. Similarly, I think the extent to which diagnostic technology and technology focused on radiation and robotic surgery has been more spotty in the past, that has changed over the last several years. So I think what we're finding is that the market will react by making greater investments in the healthcare system, and those investments will find themselves into the underlying cost of care and ultimately into the premiums that we pay across markets and for public program employees. And this is sort of a visual of the excess capacity that already exists in the market. Focusing just on the East Metro area, there are about 350 beds, unused licensed beds at St. Joseph's Hospital, a Fairview facility now, and United Hospital, an Alina facility. Clearly, health partners and regions, as Commissioner Malcolm has noted, is sort of in a unique position in the sense that it does not have bank beds and has to submit itself to public scrutiny for its growth proposal. But nevertheless, the facts remain that there is excess capacity in place already, and the proposal would likely add additional excess capacity.
Mr. Gildemeister, for the benefit of the group, if we just look at the blue boxes on the last slide, is it your finding that there's excess capacity in the East Metro if you just look at the blue boxes for the East Metro Hospital, St. Joe's Regions, and United?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the blue boxes represent available beds. So that is the capacity that hospitals operate right now to address the patient need that they're seeing. The green portion of the bars represent the capacity for which hospitals pay a license fee and presumably that they have sitting aside and are not able to cover fixed costs. So those are maybe closed units. They could also take another form. But yes, that we think of this as excess capacity because it's unused licensed bed capacity available across these facilities.
But Mr. Gildemeister, if we just look at the blue boxes, not the green, is there excess capacity in the blue boxes for the three hospitals?
Madam Chair, I imagine it is not because it represents the number of available beds that hospitals have brought to the market.
Proceed. I just wanted to clarify.
So we wanted to conclude with a point about the public comments that we've received on the proposal and the general perspective that a lot of stakeholders have taken about the proposal and Regents Hospital. So on the public comments, we've received about 49, I believe, but a broad range of stakeholders expressed their support for the Regents proposal, including elected city and county officials, healthcare providers at Regents Hospital and elsewhere, labor unions and community organizations. So expressing their support and expressing their view that Regents as an institution is an important asset to the East Metro area and the state overall. There was skepticism from a number of hospital operators about the size of the proposal and the forecast window against which it's calibrated.
And I think those are on records and available online. In and of itself, we did not find that the Strong Support Regions Hospital and its proposal enjoyed offset our concerns about the public interest nature of the proposal. But we also wanted to recognize, having looked at the role Regions Hospital plays on serving vulnerable patients, that it stands out in the East Metro area with regard to the volume of charity care it delivers in aggregate, or as we show here, per adjusted admission, and the volume of public program enrollees it sees, it serves through its institution. So having said all of this, I want to pick up the point that I mentioned early on when we started speaking about the findings, and recognize that having looked at the proposal and having looked at data, we recognize that Regions Hospital experiences bottlenecks in its delivery of care related to the capacity that it currently operates, and potentially experiences constraints to competing in the market. And for your consideration, we offer the following thoughts. So recognizing that there is a high level of occupancy at Regions Hospital, sometimes for some occasions over 90%, recognizing that Regions Hospital is already making investments in its mother baby center, the legislature, let me rephrase that, adding beds to the Regions proposal, adding limited beds to the Regions current capacity would help offset these constraints, and would help Regions Hospital to compete effectively on obstetric services. Secondly, the legislature has deliberated mental health capacity constraints across the spectrum of care. I think to some extent, hospitals become the last place, or the place where capacity constraints across the spectrum show up, and Regions Hospital, as well as other hospitals across the state, experience bottlenecks through seeing patients sit in the ER, not finding a bed at the facility, or not finding step-down care. So again, producing mental health capacity at Regions Hospitals, ideally before 2025, which under the proposal currently is anticipated, would help offset the pressure that is felt across the community. And then lastly, we have both the commission and I have highlighted some of the unintended consequences and the competitive disadvantage that the moratorium has created for hospitals who have not started out, or healthcare systems who have not started out with bank beds. And we just wanted to, I mean, let you know that we believe there are a range of options to address that inequity across the spectrum, from more regulation or much less regulation. And wanted to give that to your consideration. I think I want to close maybe by highlighting something that we have highlighted, as Commissioner Malcolm has said, repeatedly in public interest reviews. There are some systemic weaknesses of the process that you ask us to conduct, and weaknesses both, and as well as a recognition that we're looking at a very specific aspect of planning or capacity or access. So what we wanted to leave you with is are maybe two considerations. Number one, through the public interest review, we repeatedly take kind of an episodic perspective at questions of capacity, either overcapacity or
lack of access in aggregate or for certain service lines. Like, we've looked at 4 or 5 mental health proposals over time, but not really to ask how should capacity be right-sized, where should capacity exist across the state, where's the need the greatest, but rather there is a proposal. Is it in the public interest, yes or no? So that's a pretty narrow perspective on really critical questions. And I think also, and these public interest reviews, I think, bring this to the fore. There are conflicting, there is conflicting public policy at the intersection of the economics of the healthcare market, healthcare costs, payment reform, access to services, and competition. And essentially, you know, with this process, we are really focusing, in this review, we are really focusing on the public interest review from a perspective of avoiding overcapacity. At the same time, I think you as a legislative body support competition, vigorous competition in the market, because we hope it drives down healthcare costs. We're in favor of payment reform to move away from the incentives that come from fee-for-service, but that also means that we're likely going to build overcapacity into the system. So these dynamics, I think, are complex undertakings, and our public interest review was not focused on it and can't do it justice at all, but we just wanted to put this on the record for you. And with that, we are concluding our comments.
Commissioner Malcolm, if you have closing comments, we're going to ask the region's representatives to come forward, and then we'll have questions for regions, and if we need to, we will bring you back up. Okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Gildermeister's done a nice job of pointing out the specifics of the task that we have and the way that we went about answering the questions that the public interest review is about. And just to note the critical importance of these larger policy issues that we know that the legislature also thinks about and intends to work on going forward. So thank you, and we look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you. And members, because Regions is so significantly impacted by this, we're going to have them come forward as the limit for our public testimony, and then we'll do questions. Hi, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. My name is Megan Remark, and I'm the President and CEO of Regions Hospital. And then with me today,
I'm Brett Hockey, Chief Medical Officer, Regions Hospital.
Please proceed.
Thank you. So good afternoon, everyone, and thank you. I want to thank this committee for giving us the opportunity to spend a little time with you today. I know that this is a very, very busy time of year here at the Capitol, and I also understand we're following a very late night, so I very much appreciate your interest and attention in this bill today. I want to let you know that we appreciate the opportunity to share the unique and critical role that Regions Hospital plays in the East Metro community and why additional bed licenses at Regions Hospital are in the public interest. We're here because of our patients, and that probably doesn't surprise you. Everything we do, we believe, is in the public interest. We're here for our patients because behind all these numbers that we talk about, our patients deserve to have high-quality care and unique services that only we can provide in the East Metro. And we want to spend just a few minutes telling you what that means when we say we provide a unique role. So let me expand further. I think many of you know we are the East Metro's only Level 1 adult and pediatric trauma and burn center. As a trauma center, what we want you to know is that it means that no matter what time of day, we are ready to care for anyone that comes through our doors. By the American College of Surgeons standards, that's how we're licensed as a Level 1 trauma center. It also means that we can't transfer trauma patients to other East Metro hospitals with a lower level of care. It's part of what it means to be a Level 1 trauma hospital. All other East Metro hospitals are level 3 or level 4 designated centers. The other hospitals in our community send patients to us with complex orthopedics, hand, otolaryngology, and plastic and reconstructive surgery needs. Our trauma surgeons, our anesthesiologists, intensive care physicians, and internal medicine physicians have an added requirement that many are in-house 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with additional backup physicians on call in the case of a mass casualty with a 30-minute response time. This is not the case in other hospitals. Other specialists, in addition to those in-house from orthopedics, neurosurgery, interventional radiology, otolaryngology, burn surgery, plastics, and others, also have a robust call coverage and presence within 30 minutes. There's an OR team in place 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with additional backup teams on call. With a nationally recognized burn center that was one of the first in the country, we receive burn and frostbite patients from as far away as Montana and the Dakotas. No other East Metro hospital or facility is equipped or skilled to care for these individuals. They cannot go to another hospital. It also means that we are the hospital ready to care for patients in the event of a mass casualty incident. In addition to providing level one trauma and burn capabilities, we're proud about the fact that we've had a long tradition in providing comprehensive medical and chemical health services. We saw this need and continuing need over the years and made a choice to invest in our community by expanding and updating our mental health bed capacity within our existing license. By adding those beds, it was not allowing us to add in other needed areas like medicine and surgical specialties. We used our existing bed licenses to add 20 beds over the last 10 years, and we currently operate a fairly new 100-bed inpatient mental health unit with all single rooms. We also have a number of innovative outpatient mental health programs, including our fourth intensive residential treatment center, which opened in February, because our goal is to only have people inpatient that need to be inpatient. We know that a lot more needs to be done to provide outpatient options for patients and their family members that does not exist today. But even this morning, we had 12 patients waiting in our emergency department who needed to be admitted to a mental health facility, and there was no capacity in the East Metro. All 100 of our beds were full as well. Finally, we're also very proud, and I think this is one of the things we're the most proud of, is that we are the safety net hospital and the biggest charity care provider in the East Metro, providing more than $17 million of uncompensated care in 2016 alone. And we do this without financial support from Ramsey County. This is something that we have continued and have been doing this for many, many years and hope to continue to do in the future. And finally, Regions is a significant teaching hospital. We train more than 500 residents a year. We think this makes us better, and we are actively partnering with the university and other hospitals to provide this care. Now, in the preliminary public interest report that you just heard about, the Minnesota Department of Health shared their perspective on this proposal. We're glad that MDH agrees we need more beds for OBGYN, for medicine and surgical specialties, and for mental health. But it also probably won't surprise you that we were surprised and disappointed that the department didn't find more beds in the public interest. We think that that's misleading. In reference to Section 1 of the report, we believe it's entirely responsible and prudent to project out into future years using both internal and external data, and we took our data analysis very seriously. And even while we look to the future, we know that right now our bed shortage is showing up in very real ways and will only worsen. Let me share with you a little bit of what happens when we don't have capacity in the East Metro. When we have no capacity to admit a patient, our team calls another hospital to see if they have a bed available, if that patient could be seen somewhere else. What our experience has been is that often the surrounding East Metro hospitals either don't offer the specialized services needed or don't have the capacity either. Then we need to find temporary space for patients, which we call boarding. That includes taking care of patients in the hallways of our emergency department. And research shows that nationally, boarding is a public health crisis. It's not just here in Minnesota. It places patients at high risk for adverse events and interferes with our ability to function properly in the event of a disaster. Once we are out of capacity to see patients due to boarding, we have no choice but to close to ambulance arrivals. In 2017, there were 95 events. These are not mental health. There were 95 events in the Twin Cities where all hospitals in a service area needed to go on divert for non-mental health. and DIVERT is where we could no longer accept patients. 92 of those 95 events were in the East Metro. This shows that you can have licensed beds but still have a community where there are not enough beds in use to service our patient population. Now, it's true that hospitals in Minnesota have seen amazing progress on reducing inpatient days, and we're actually better than the national average, which is what we based our analysis on. We've also seen this progress slow as there's less room to improve. So here's how this shows up at Regions. For example, we have far fewer inpatient chest pain cases than we did only 5 years ago. We don't need to admit patients with chest pain anymore. We have a way to evaluate them and treat them either in our emergency department or not in a hospital bed in observation. But also with reduced numbers of inpatient chest pain cases, new cases have taken their place as medical advancements can save lives today that otherwise would have been lost. So while national analysis show that inpatient use will decline, it will not decline as dramatically in Minnesota because we've already reduced inpatient admissions lower than the average in the U.S. Now, in Section 2 of the report, the concern of the financial viability of other health systems was raised, and we want to talk a little bit about that. Regions is proud to be a part of the Health Partners Integrated Delivery System. Our model is one that other systems are increasingly trying to emulate. Our system has been successful through the relentless pursuit of what we call the triple aim, providing highest quality care with the best possible experience at the most affordable price. In fact, we've just received new data from Optum Insight. The latest numbers show that Health Partners' total cost of care is 17% lower than the Minnesota benchmark, which is something we think consumers very much appreciate and need. I also want to correct an inaccuracy we noticed in the preliminary report from MDH on page 4, where it says that two-thirds of Health Partners networks restrict patients to Regions Hospital alone. That is simply not correct. None of the Health Partners networks restrict patients only to Regions Hospital. The idea that Health Partners can force individuals to receive care only at Regions is not true. The truth is that Regions is a community hospital and serves everyone. In fact, in 2017, only 13% of Regions Hospital inpatients had Health Partners commercial insurance. Now, I know I've been throwing some numbers at you, but I have just a few more. When we look at where our patients come from, 65% of Regions inpatients come from our emergency department. Those are people that land at our door because of unexpected circumstances. Nobody wakes up every morning thinking they're going to end up in the emergency department. We have to take care of those patients. The other 35% of inpatients come primarily through referrals from primary care physicians, and every system in town has a primary care network that is loyal to one of the systems in town. That is not only happening at Regions or Health Partners, that's happening in every other system. We think the idea that you should artificially constrain Regions' capacity and in effect force Regions to turn away emergency patients that want or need to be at Regions and can't be transferred elsewhere, which we can't send somewhere else in the example of trauma, is the wrong approach and will have very dire consequences for patients. One of the best examples of this is the story included in your packet from Dr. Karen Quade. Dr. Karen Quade is one of our emergency physicians, but she became a family member when she saw her mother collapse from cardiac arrest. They were quickly brought in an ambulance to the Regions Hospital Emergency Department. She was seen promptly, but when time came to admit her, there was already a line of patients waiting for a bed. 13 hours later, they were still waiting in the emergency room, and that while this story has a happy ending, it highlights how care was compromised because of capacity constraints in our emergency department. In addition, our analysis shows that the growing and aging population in the East Metro will require that all of the St. Paul hospitals should be staffing more beds to care for patients in our community. Our request for 100 additional bed licenses is based on serving the same percentage of the population that Regions serves today while factoring in projected demographic changes over the next 20 years. One of the things that I feel that this group should be very proud of is everyone provides great care. We get great health care in the state of Minnesota. Every hospital plays a critical role in the health of our community. United and St. Joseph's hospitals do an excellent job and they have excess beds. But in the East Metro, a bed is not a bed. In response to Section 3, I'd like to reiterate that Regions is different than United and St. Joseph's in that we provide care and services that they currently do not and cannot provide. Other hospitals rely on our specialized services, In fact, in the past year, other St. Paul hospitals transferred more than 600 patients to Regents Hospital to get that specialized care. Now, in Section 4, the Minnesota Department of Health acknowledges that Regents Hospital plays a critical role important to the community, and that we have a number of public and private sector supporters who believe our request is in the public interest, and we have included those today, those letters today, for your review. I'd like to close with one final thought. Our beds are not interchangeable with other beds at other hospitals. We do provide care that others don't, and here are three examples. When a man was pinned underneath his truck, seven highly specialized trauma surgeons spent hours working to save his arm. This can only happen at East Metro Hospital that staffs Level 1 trauma. When a 61-year-old Oak Park Heights man was burned in an explosion at his home and was given just 20% chance of survival, Regions is the only place in the East Metro that could treat him. After 264 days at Regions Hospital in our burn center, he was able to walk out of our doors, returning to his home and to his family. That's a very different situation when you think that the average length of stay for most hospital visits is 4 days. Many of the patients that we take care of as a Level 1 trauma facility stay there longer. We need to have capacity to be able to serve all of the needs of our community and our share of the market. And finally, our third story, 14-year-old Willie fell from his skateboard. He was initially taken to another St. Paul hospital, but the team there knew he needed a higher level of care, so he was rushed to Regions. Our doctors discovered three brain bleeds and a fractured skull. Willie had a traumatic brain injury that was not picked up. And Willie's doctor performed an immediate craniotomy and literally ran into surgery to give him the best chance of survival. With the trauma team's accurate diagnosis and fast-acting decision-making, Willie was soon able to start the journey of recovery. Again, this can only happen at a Level 1 trauma facility. These are just three stories of hundreds that have been shared at Regents Hospital, where it's abundantly clear how Regents plays a critical and unique and unmatched role in the East Metro. They're just a snapshot of the people that inspire us here to be here today. They count on us, and so many others will count on us in the years to come. At Regents, we have a saying that every patient is everyone's patient. And this is a philosophy that we live by every day. We don't leave anyone behind, and each team member has a role to play in serving our patients. We hope that you will allow us to continue to be there for every single patient who wants and needs to be cared for at Regions. And we're glad that MDH agreed we need capacity for OB, med-surg, and mental health, and our community and state are counting on us. That's why our request, we believe, is in the public interest. We thank you for your interest and attention.
Thank you. Could I ask, is that testimony available in writing? Is that something we could distribute to the committee after the hearings are over?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Remark. I'm going to start questions from members for Health Partners, and then after we think we've gotten through questions for Health Partners, we'll bring MDH back up to clarify, but I wanted to make sure that our conversation was framed with the key stakeholder having the opportunity to speak. I have started a speakers list of representatives Liebling, Munson, and Quam. Others, you know, raise your hand as we progress through. So, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My question was for MDH.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Representative Munson. Okay. Then I'm going to ask, we'll leave that list for MDH, but I'd like questions for the region's folks as long as they're available.
Madam Chair.
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you talk to us a little bit about where your census is at? I know you talked about the mental health and the fact that you have 12 people waiting for a bed this morning. Could you talk about your general census and where you're at and just kind of where you are, where it's best practices to be at for capacity and that sort of thing a little bit more?
Oh, sure. Ms. Raymark. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question was, where are we today from a census and capacity perspective, and what is industry standard? Industry standard is about 80% capacity, because you need flexibility. All hospitals do to flex up and down to meet the changing needs. Not everybody comes in, sequentially. Sometimes we have surges of patients, so all hospitals ideally want to run at 80%. Regents Hospital for the last 3 years have run much hotter than that, and right now we are running about an average occupancy or capacity of 88%. Today we were at 97, which means we were using a majority of our 454 licensed beds. And one of the things that I want this group to know is that we take seriously all of the effort and energy it takes to come and talk to the legislature about additional bed licenses. One, we know we're the only ones in the market that need to do it. But second is we opened 24 beds in the last 24 months in the hopes that that would get us back to 80%. And we opened our last 12 beds literally on February 1st, and we have filled them. And so we have worked hard, actually, to delay the need to come back in the hopes that we saw a change in our census. And we continue to see that as a regional level one trauma and burn center, the volume is there.
Thank you.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is, so you had said that Regents allows people with other policies outside of health partners to come into the into Regents Hospital. I guess my question is, how many? What I heard from MDH was that that two-thirds of health partners policyholders can only go to Regents. Is that correct? And if that is, so does that mean only one-third can go to United or St. John's?
So it is not clear to us how the Minnesota Department of Health drew that conclusion. From what we understand, the reference was made only to the individual market, which is only 5% of Minnesotans. Everyone else is in a different product. And even if it was only the 5%, we do not offer products that only are directed to Regents Hospital. So we saw this report yesterday, and we don't understand the information because that's not true.
Representative Cagle.
So would those other hospitals then be in-network?
Ms. Remark.
From a health plan perspective, there are very few, I don't think any, products that only use one hospital, and certainly it's not Regions. So the products, people can go to other hospitals, yes.
Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the challenge of this topic, and these are some of the harder decisions we have to make. I'm interested, and so I just have a question, just a comment, and then I'm just going to listen. So we're faced with a sack of paper from somebody who likes it. At the hearing, no one came to testify against it, but St. Joe is going to go out of business or something if we do this. And it's interesting how much this is discussed kind of behind the scenes. Anyway, that's my editorial thought and not productive to the discussion, frankly, if you've been behind the scenes. But anyway, so you asked for 100 beds, which is kind of a round number, maybe significant to one digit in some scientific work. But can you describe how that's the number? And it seems like the number going home is something between 100, or between 1 and probably 99. So could you describe why that number is so important to you as being 100? It seems like the Department of Health agrees you need a few. So this is your chance to describe maybe Plan B or why that's the number. Thank you.
Ms. Remark. Thank you, Senator, for your question. So we did not make up 100. We actually did an analysis internally and then externally and took a look at the demographics as well as the changing nature of medicine. And so while we agree that a 30-year timeline is a long one, we also wanted to be responsible about understanding if the need would continue beyond a nearer term. And so our analysis was based on the fact that a bed is not a bed even within each hospital, and that you need sufficient beds in medicine and surgery. That includes intensive care beds, as well as mental health and OBGYN. So it was really based on the demographics. For example, even though we are asking for OB beds, that's to allow moms and babies to be in one room together. It actually is not expanding the number of beds. I think we will expand two beds from what we have today, And even with St. Joseph's no longer delivering babies, we think that we've seen in the data that the demographics show that we don't need to add additional OBGYN beds because the future does not support that from a demographic perspective. So mental health has one analysis, OBGYN has another analysis, and MedSurg has another, and that's how we came up with the 100 beds.
Another thing to mention is that Minnesota's already a low utilization state. We don't think we're hospitalizing people that don't need to be hospitalized. So some of the national data that's being extracted to talk about future growth, I think, is not quite the same as it is in Minnesota. MDH said that they didn't have very good projections for sure to know what the future holds. What I do know is that there are 46 million Americans right now over the age of 65, and by 2060, they're going to be 98 million. So there's going to be more than doubling of the number of people over the age of 65. And I don't, for one, don't think that no matter how good we provide health care, that sooner or later those people aren't going to need hospitalization or help at the end of their life. And so our hospital projections around the growth, we feel is quite solid. The other thing I'll mention is that just to get us to a manageable capacity so we don't have to leave people in the hallway, just that alone requires beds. And you can do the math from what I'm rounding off to 90% down to 85% or 80%, how many beds you'd need just to make that capacity up, which isn't even more patients through the door. So I think that the number of beds we need is fairly solid. Yet two-thirds of those beds are going to be by 2025, we think. But I should mention that our system is a community-run organization where we are absolutely committed to giving people the best care, which includes trying to get people into different kind of care models that does not include hospitalization. So we will not bring on any beds whatsoever that just to bring them on. It will only be where demand and it is required by sick patients. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In building just a little bit up what Representative Cagle, I think, was asking, just the statement in the detailed preliminary findings, wondering if you could just shed a little light and just respond to this around that there's evidence to suggest that the vertical integration between the health partners, insurance function, and the provider systems has the potential to benefit regions over time by shifting patients toward regions. And then it talks a little bit more about the incentives to create limited provider networks. Would you just shed a little light and respond a little bit more to that? It'd be helpful. Thank you.
Sorry, Mark. Thank you, Representative. So a couple things. One is that we are a vertically integrated system, and we're very proud of that. And every single system in town is doing the same thing. So we are not unique in this market. Other systems are developing insurance products, and all the other systems in town have primary care, specialty care, and hospitals within their network. Everyone's changed their name to health, not just health care. So we don't apologize for the fact that our vertical integrated system benefits patients. The state of Minnesota, many of us are all in the same electronic medical record, so when patients move between systems, it makes their health information that much more portable. I think we should be proud of that. And all primary care docs that are aligned with their systems refer into their systems. So what we take issue with is that the report makes it sound as if that is only a health partner strategy, and that is not the case. And we do not feel that that should restrain our ability to grow, given the fact that as a level one trauma and the system providing the most amount of charity care as a private hospital, it doesn't seem reasonable for us to understand why it would be in the community interest to cap our ability when we're the only ones that can't grow right now.
Thank you. Senator Jensen.
I do have a question. But first off, to colleagues. It was in 1984 that we instituted the moratorium on hospitals because the certificate of need wasn't working. And we did that for two reasons. Basically, the legislature was concerned about the overcapacity in licensed beds and then the potential cost that goes with overcapacity, because it's sort of like that baseball movie, build it and they will come. And so I think in 2001, we had a system that was similar to health partners today, and that's what scares people out in the world of healthcare. Is that we had a system that was called Allina, and Mike Hatch insisted that they break apart. So Allina broke away from Medica. But they had the perfect storm. They had the hospitals and clinics, they had the doctors, but they had the insurance. And I think that previous comments sort of didn't mention the fact that when you have the insurance on, you have a tremendous potential for controlling the system. Networks have been an increasingly used tool in our healthcare system today, whether you're dealing with OB-GYN groups or whether you're dealing with primary care groups. And as a general rule, Health Partners, I'm sure, has achieved much of its excellence because it has indeed tried to use all the tools at its available means. But there is something special about this request because I think that Health Partners is a powerful, vertically integrated, consolidated organization. And I think that the original means for why we had the hospital moratorium put in place, those concerns still are present because I've been in the ER, and I'm sure Senator Klein, you have as well. And the bottom line is, if you're told by the head nurse we're at 95%, you're going to do everything you can to not admit the patient. And oftentimes, when we do admit patients in those situations, we will turf them to another hospital if we can. And 84%, 80%, whatever you want to have. I mean, this will have a profound impact on the other hospitals in the area. And I think that part of the rationale originally was, we're not one system. We're one bigger system in terms of paying the bills. So I admire Health Partners immensely. But I guess the question I would have would be, what do you think is the most compelling reason that we should go away from the 1984 concerns that if we have more hospital beds, we'll fill more hospital beds, and the overall cost of health care to this community being a large general?
Okay, you said quite a bit there.
What has changed from 1984 that would negate the logic that was utilized to say we do not want to build capacity at best because if we do that, we will provide a stimulus for increasing cost of health?
So from our perspective, it is not our role to advocate for or against the moratorium. We are dealing with what is currently in place. And I think that we are asking for an exception to the moratorium because the way in which beds were banked in 84 does not represent the reality of the situation that we are facing today at Regents Hospital. So what's different is the fact that only 13% of Regents Hospital patients are from a Health Partners product. That's over 85% that's not Health Partners. And we are doing more than our fair share of uncompensated care, and we need to be able to grow in all areas to be financially viable. So only adding mental health or only adding OB, which are not profitable services, particularly because of the amount of Medicaid, is a problem for us. We are very interested, and we do more than our fair share across the entire community need. And so what's different for us is the increasing amount of Medicaid and Medicare and decreasing commercial insurance, which all organizations are facing. And so we do not want to turn away trauma. We don't today. We don't turn away trauma. We don't turn away burn or stroke. But we also need to make sure we are prepared for the future and that we have the capacity. And what I am not clear on is why we didn't have that, why we don't, you know, the banked beds thing was a point-in-time assignment that advantaged some systems over others, and Regents Hospital was at the short end of that.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Senator Jensen.
Hey. What do you think that when Alina and break off Medicare, because they had both the insurance arm and the environment, and then Health Partners later on, they joined the partner group. How do you balance that? In terms of what happened in 2001 and where we are in 2018. Because what was not okay for one is okay now for Health Partners.
I appreciate the question. I feel like that's outside the scope of what we're asking for today.
I think within the context of vertical integration and the fact that we spent 9 months on the Senate Select Committee trying to bend the cost curve downwards, and I think vertical integration has demonstrated fairly clearly that it's not reducing costs for the most part. The fact of the matter is when you bring a clinic into a vertically integrated system, generally your fees go up 30-40%, the reimbursement does as well. So I think it's a valid question in the context of trying to bend the overall cost curve down health in this.
So is it pertinent that our clinics accept and want patients that have any insurance, not just health partners, and the patients that carry the health partners' cards, we have to earn their service. We allow, they can go anywhere that they want, almost anywhere. You know, so it's a very open market now where we think that people have the right to choose their health care. And so, and we need to earn it based on the kind of care we provide. We don't, in fact, force them to go to our system except for a couple of very narrow networks.
Thank you. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically what I see is we've got two things. We've got the current concerns and issues with capacity, but we also have intelligently deciding where we need to be in the near future, 10, 20 years. Both regions and what Director Gildemeister touched on the fact that our forecasting is really not very good. But I understand the Regents has done the forecasting, and it'd be nice to understand, you know, the missing factors, the rescaling of factors, how things have changed. We've had a little bit of a history thing, but things have changed because we worked on decreasing readmissions. We worked on alternative settings so that we have shorter duration stays. We have new procedures for outpatient, pharmacology, medical equipment, et cetera, that are impacting both the distribution and the multi-layered interdependency of your different, you know, types of beds and your mix. So it'd be nice, I think, for the committee to understand and get a glimpse of both the department's methodology and their look at new factors to be able to, you know, do the forecasting, and what somebody who's, you know, their lifeblood, their future is dependent on accurate and updated. So it'd be really, I think, good offline to get some of that information so we can better understand and make the decisions that aren't, okay, this snapshot is good, but 5-10 years down the line, we don't want to be caught off guard. I really would like to have some clarity on the mental health beds and the timing. Looking at the presentation, we're waiting six years before adding, but almost everyone I've talked to, you know, in different regions of the state, we have a problem of capacity for mental health beds. I mean, we're having people sent, instead of local, where they still have the family connectivity, they're being sent all over the state and sometimes neighboring states. So being able to better understand the what you have behind the covers for your decision and get it from MDH, we can maybe better make a better decision on policy besides just this snapshot of are we going to allow X number of beds. And so it's both to maybe Regents can talk about how they are differing from the MDH forecast and why they came up with their numbers and the dynamics.
And Representative Kwame, I'm going to insert what MDH work done is ours, and we will ask for that from the department. I will talk with Regents. Generally, internal work is proprietary, and so I think it is not fair in a public forum to ask for that, but they have now heard the request, and if they believe it is something that would be valuable to make be made public, I will leave that to them, but I think it is inappropriate for us to ask for private work product to be made public, respectfully, but I will ask the department because it should be public.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I think maybe they could let the chairs are a small, select few into a cloistered environment to be able to glean some of the insights and wisdom of which they've procured.
Thank you. And I look forward to being cloistered with Representative Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if The testifiers could comment on, I guess my questions are around the mental health capacity as well, and how it fits in and who you think it will serve. I mean, when we are hearing testimony at the legislature, this is who we're hearing from. Families, particularly families with children or adolescents who are having to have their children hospitalized out of state very often. I've said, you know, when your kid is sick, you don't want to be across the room from them, much less hundreds of miles away. And so it's a concern that we hear a lot here at the legislature, and it's hard. And I think that it's unfortunate. I know that you referenced the way healthcare is paid for, and that mental health very often is paid for with public dollars, which is a lower reimbursement rate. And I think that that's very unfortunate. One of the things I think that we need to think about in terms of, and this is a long-term plan, so I think we can insert some long-term expectations in terms of the conversations we need to have, is about reimbursement and the way that we pay for healthcare, because we can't make the less profitable patient a less desirable patient, because this is really where we're seeing significant bottlenecks within the system statewide. And so when you look at adding those 20 beds to, you know, it's not very long, I guess, 2025, but I mean, it's not today. So do you intend to serve specific age groups? How do you see that changing the bottleneck in mental health? Because indeed, you had one today, it sounds like, as well. So thanks, if you could comment.
Okay. Thank you very much for your question. So I would say two things about that. We could probably be here all day on this topic. But I would say two things in general. Number one is that we are committed to the full continuum of care. When we say full continuum, our goal is to only hospitalize inpatients if that is the only place they should be. And right now, sometimes people get into a crisis and there aren't outpatient services available. So within our integrated system, we have added clinics. We have added intensive residential treatment services. We've added partial hospitalization services. And we've had some innovative programs. One, in fact, is called Daybridge, where it's a six-hour program for 3 to 4 weeks so that patients who maybe come out of a hospital have a safety net before they're just out in the community on their own. So we do feel like the solution to mental health issues in the state of Minnesota is multifactorial, not just inpatient hospital beds. At Regents Hospital, we serve adults only. We do not provide pediatric services. And over 95% of the patients that we see in our inpatient mental health unit, as an example, come out of our emergency department. So, again, we do not hold beds for health partners. We do not preferentially see health partners patients in the inpatient setting. It comes in on a first-come, first-served basis and almost exclusively in our emergency department, so much so that we actually renovated our emergency department mental health area, which is, I believe it's 12 beds of a locked unit in the emergency department, so that we can safely begin treatment for patients, and either they are transferred into our facility as we discharge patients, or they go to another facility, because there is a lot of cooperation in the state of Minnesota to try and match the patient need with a bed. So it is a challenge. It is a challenge.
And Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I really had some kind of basic beginning questions for the Department of Health that I gathered a little bit more just from the discussion. But so I don't know if they want to come forward. I don't know if other members need this as well. But I just wanted to ask about the looking at the slide on page 12 about the extra beds, who has them. I'm not really clear about how that came about, why some institutions have these extra licenses that are being unused as opposed to others, although I kind of gathered that was something about how this was done originally. I kind of like to understand a little more about how we got to where we are. And then also to understand a bit more about whether these beds are just, you know, the ones that are banked, that say the St. Joseph's has these 170 bed licenses that they're not using. Are these, once we allocate these bed licenses, are they just simply unrestricted so that these institutions can use them for mental health or whatever they want? And then kind of thirdly, I'm looking for a little guidance about what our charge is or what our ability is here as a legislature, whether we can grant some exceptions with conditions, whether we could say you can do certain number of this kind of bed and not that kind, and then how that would be enforced. So those are sort of my basic questions I just kind of wanted to lay out there for more for the department, I think.
Yep. Representative Liebling, we had you on the MDH list. You are at the top. But we also put you on the region's list. I thought you had indicated.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay. I did not mean to be on the region's list.
Very good. Well, we will have the department back up as soon as we move through members. Representative Grunhagen and then Representative Dean.
Are these? Oh, they are. Okay. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a couple comments and observations. You know, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for the wonderful care that you provide. And, you know, the way I see it from your testimony and the MDH's proposal, you know, you wanted 100 additional beds. You see the demographics changing. You see the low reimbursement for Medicaid and Medicare. And it's going to endanger your economic viability going forward. So you want these additional beds to create additional revenue in your level one trauma center. Then you've got hospitals around you with excess capacity. They're faced with the same situation, lower reimbursement for Medicare and Medicaid, fewer commercial patients. They just assume you refer some of your patients over to those hospitals to fill their beds rather than expand yours. So, the way I see things, we have to decide which hospital organization we wish to favor, all right? And which gives me another conclusion, the observation that expanding Minnesota Care and low reimbursement into our medical centers is only going to make things worse, not better. And I know you want to stay ahead of the rest of the hospitals, but they're faced with the same situation, and we see the same situation out in the rural area. So one more time, why should we favor your hospital association over your competitors who would like to see referrals over to their empty beds?
Ms. Remark. Thank you for your question. We're not asking you to favor us over others. We're actually asking to have a fair playing field. Every hospital in St. Paul has a role to play, and every day all three of our emergency departments, United, St. Joseph's, and Regents Hospital, partner together at the caregiver level, both from a mental health perspective and from an ambulance arrival perspective. And so we have, I think you can be really proud of the fact that we have protocols in place so that patients do not slip through the cracks as one or all hospitals are on divert. What we're seeing is that there are too often, as I stated in our report, 93 times where all three hospitals were not able to take a patient. We don't think that that is a sustainable strategy or anything that the East Metro region should tolerate. So we believe all three hospitals should add beds, and we are ready to do that now, and we do not have to build a huge new building to do it. We have Sheldon space for mental health, and we have our towers that have been around since the 1950s that we can renovate and put additional beds in without building a new bed tower, which would be much lower cost. So we're not asking for favoritism. We're asking for an equal playing field. And we would encourage the other hospitals to take a look at our same information and consider adding beds. And we recognize that can be an expensive endeavor because as we understand it to what we know, the other hospitals do not have immediate space to add right now.
Madam Chair, just
briefly, Representative.
Oh, just one follow-up question for the committee or comment for the committee and observation. You know, this isn't going to go away, obviously, okay? This is going to continue to be a problem. And I think a year ago, the head of the Rochester Mayo was down at Washington, D.C., and he made the comment quoted in Minneapolis Tribune that the mayor was going to favor private pay patients over government pay patients. So if we don't come up with some type of solution to reform this system, we are going to wind up with a two-tier healthcare system, one for the rich, the privileged, and the connected, and a second-rate one for those on government healthcare. Unfortunately, that's what we're facing, and I believe we have to address that through reforms and a change of how this is going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dean and then Senator Luria, I apologize. You had signaled earlier, and I didn't get you on the list. So Representative Dean.
Thank you, Senator Benenson. I did kind of one question and then a follow-up, and then I'd probably ask the same one from the for the department on the first one. Just to talk a little bit about divert and how that works. I have heard more in the last couple of years about that, about more hospitals going on divert more often, how that impacts your patients and people trying to get there. And it seems like hospitals go on divert a lot more now than they used to, realizing that you got less patients. Patients are in your hospital for fewer days, but it seems like people get waived off more often. How does that work for decision-making around when to go on divert, and how much of that is driven by staffing? And then could you talk a little bit about, do we make you report that, and do we keep track of that? Does the department get that information, and how are we kind of watching that and deciding about that stuff?
That's right, Mark. Okay, thank you for, I think there were several questions there. So let me try and address a few. Diverts are on the rise, and I believe we have information in your handout regarding the all East Metro hospitals increasing ED closure hours. So this is for all of the East Metro. This is information that we do report to the Minnesota Department of Health on Metro Hospital and ED closures. So it's this slide and I think your information. So we have a protocol for going on divert. We have divert for medicine and surgery, and we have divert for mental health. And so the crisis is in both areas of medical care. What a divert means is if a hospital is overwhelmed either in the emergency department, and we have a pretty high threshold in all of our hospitals, we try hard not to go on divert in any of our hospitals because we know that means delaying care for patients. But if we do go on divert, that just prevents the ambulances from arriving at that hospital. Once all three hospitals are in the East Metro go on divert at the same time, then we take turns boarding patients. And that's why we think that this is not just a problem for Regions, but for the East Metro. Same thing applies for mental health. So we do have criteria. Our emergency room medical directors talk as a team between our hospitals, and we do increasingly report the data. Now, in addition, as you know, patients walk into an emergency department because they drive themselves there at times. So we don't just get ambulances arriving at hospital emergency departments. So even when we're on divert, we could still have someone walk in with a very serious injury or having a heart attack or a stroke, and no hospital can turn that away. That's why we have this boarding protocol, where we have to treat patients in the halls outside of emergency department rooms themselves. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's helpful, and is I think that's important to understand kind of who decides that and when and how and what the criteria are, because I think that is kind of an important thing to think about. And just secondarily, you know, obviously the request is there, read the, you know, the reply from the department. You're obviously not happy about that. What are you going to do if you don't get this, and what's the plan moving forward as you're growing and Western Wisconsin's growing, and what's the plan?
Very Mark. Thank you for the question. We are still very hopeful that we will secure additional bed licenses for Regions during this legislative session. That's why we're here. And if we do not get beds, we are going to have to take a hard look at what and how we provide the care. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, this goes back a little bit to the last question Representative Dean just asked, and going back to Senator Abler's question as well. You know, we have, you know, I think like 2.5 weeks left here. Right now we have sort of a binary option in front of us, a yes or a no on a proposal. And we now have, you know, a preliminary report, but it seems to me like it's probably not going to change, that this entire request, you know, it would not be in the public interest to approve the entire request. And having that binary choice puts us in a real box. I mean, I, for one, I'm going to have a hard time voting yes for 100-bed capacity over a 32-year window. And I will say I did have a little heartburn over a request that did last over a 32-year window, to tell you the truth, in a rapidly changing environment that we are going to have to monitor closely over that period. And we don't know where it goes, but I have a hard time believing that inpatient hospital is really sort of the vision of the future for healthcare. But that's a little bit of a side note. And I worried with this, if it were to be found in the public interest and we approved it, I think that would be the pattern that we saw. I mean, I don't think anybody would come in for anything other than, you know, 30 years, and we would really have to do a much deeper dive and try to figure out new tools to manage this. So, I mean, I know this is very late-breaking information, and I don't mean to put you on the spot today, Jim. And Senator Aber already sort of asked the question, and your response was that it is your opinion that the 100 beds is in the public interest. But I would encourage you to think a little bit and see if you could help us come, because I think it would be too bad if we left with that binary choice and we chose zero, because I think that there really is a need that is highlighted by the MDH public interest review. And I worry about the binary 100-bed, 32-year yes or no. I mean, if I'm a no and I'm, you know, putting you in an even more awkward spot where you have to go back to the drawing board, I hope that over the next, you know, couple of days that we can sit down and try to scope out something that the legislature could do. And I actually do look forward to more conversations with regions. I really do value the partnership of regions and the critical safety net role that you play in the East Metro and have for a very long time. But we could use some help coming to a smoother glide path this session than saying no to a proposal that in its entirety is looks like it'll be hard to swallow. So you don't have to answer today, but, you know, I hope that we can have some fruitful meetings and try to find some middle ground and then look for some of these options that MDH said that they had for us to think about. I don't know if any of those come across the finish line this year or not. I do worry about some of the competitive disadvantages that you're placed at. You know, I get that argument, and I'm sensitive to that as well. But right now we have a bill. It's a yes or no. We're probably going to have to find some other place to be, or it's a yes or no, and I worry about the no.
Ms. Remark, would you? I'm not going to ask you to answer an unanswerable question at this point.
No, I appreciate your comments, and you know, we received the Minnesota Department of Health's analysis yesterday at noon, and so we have reviewed it to the best we can up until this point, and we hear you loud and clear, and I'm interested in more conversation for sure.
Thank you.
And Senator Jensen, this will be your last question. For Regents.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I evidently used up my quota.
No, this is your last question for the hearing. This is our last question for Regents.
Gracias. Thank you. And thank you, Senator Miller, for stating that far better than I could. I mean, the last thing I want to do is penalize health partners for being excellent. I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to look at what they're doing in the area of opiates, and I mean, they're training residents, and breadth of your impact is huge. And yet, what we do here in the next week or two does have precedent. And so we have to be thoughtful. And so this or this, and we have this document. So what do? We scuttle the document. So I have been impressed with the chairman of the Health and Human Services Committee on the Senate side and her ability to negotiate and work with people. And I'm certain that we have the same situation in the is it the lower body?
Not today.
So I suspect over conversation going forward, and I really appreciate you allowing me to ask a hard question because I think people
Thank you. Thank you very much for the time you took this afternoon. I'm sure all of us are going to be in touch. If we could have the department come back up. Members, we're going to try to do a quick round. I did say 4:30, but this is an important issue with some pretty dedicated people making time. So I'll give some latitude. I hope we wrap by 5. But let's focus on the department answering some questions. Welcome back. I'm going to start with Representative Liebling, and then Representative Munson and Representative Quam are on my MDH list. Let's build the list. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so you heard my questions before. I guess I was a little bit anticipating where we might be able to go with this, and I appreciate some of the comments from Senator Lurie and others about wanting to tailor this a little bit. And so I guess I first wanted, maybe it would have been more helpful for me at the beginning of the conversation, but just to understand a little bit better, how we got to where some of the institutions have a bunch of extra licenses and others have none or few. And then, are these, when they have these extra licenses, can they just use them in whatever way they choose, which I assume the answer to that is going to be yes. And then maybe you're not even the right ones to ask. Maybe it's just within our legislative purview to do this, but whether we can attach conditions to the licenses and how that might be enforced or how this whole license thing is enforced. Actually, maybe you could give me whether we have had some history of attaching conditions to licenses.
Thank you. And respectfully, Commissioner, I'm going to direct the questions to Mr. Gildemeister, but if you would like to comment, just please step in. Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, three tough and good questions, so I'll try to answer them quickly. How did we get here? Essentially, hospitals annually apply for a license of beds, and what the dynamic the moratorium has created essentially is that hospitals do not de-license beds that they're currently not using. So how have hospitals come up with a bank of beds? Through the process of consolidation and closing hospitals, sort of in response to a change of how inpatient care is delivered. So we used to be overbedded. Many hospitals have closed and changed. The buildings have changed. The beds are retained typically by healthcare providers, by hospital operators. I assume in the case they become useful in the future. Can the legislature, can they be used however hospitals wish to use them? I think the answer is yes, although I'm not an expert on that. There are some requirements related to the Medicare program. If hospital services are licensed to meet CMS conditions, and in those cases they can only deliver the services for which they are licensed. But a licensed bed is a licensed bed, with the exception of rehab beds, I believe, and beds in the mental health space when they're certified to be a certain CMS certified federal unit. So essentially the answer is typically they can be used, however they it's suited to the hospital. There are practical and workflow considerations and also what kind of equipment runs to the room to accommodate whatever care needs to be delivered. But that's maybe more a question for experts on the hospital side. In terms of your question about attaching conditions to an exception, it's been done in the past, but I think it's complicated by my answer to the second question. You can add conditions, but They're difficult to enforce because a licensed bed is a licensed bed. So in the past, there's been one exception that required that a hospital added mental health beds to their new hospital license, and that's not occurred in the sense that a separate unit was set aside for mental health services. Patients are seen with a secondary mental health diagnosis. So in that case, I would say the enforcement has been difficult, and the hospital has decided to deliver the services with along the lines of what the legislature had imagined, turned out not to make sense for them operationally. So a short answer to your question is, yes, you can attach conditions. To enforce them may be tricky.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Director Gildemeister. It'd be nice to understand the analysis of the subgroup capacity and needs, such as mental health, pediatrics, and obstetrics, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, you know, all our information is on the public record, so we're happy to share them in the form in which they're currently available, in more detailed form in the enclosure to the letter, but the final report in May will also have additional information available. If you have questions in the meantime, we can certainly make them available to you. I think the point that I wanted to make or leave the legislature with is to say, you know, a simple projection of hospital beds to us looks not like it will produce sharp estimates of actual bed needs. And mostly because facts like a hepatitis C drug coming online that will treat patients who otherwise spend a lot of time in the hospital dramatically changes pattern of healthcare use. The federal agency, CMS, permitting that certain knee replacements occur in outpatient settings will shift care to outpatient settings. The recession has reduced demand for inpatient care. Technology will do the same. Yes, there are some circumstances where new pharmacological treatments enable people to survive longer and maybe experience a hospital stay. But in our read on the trends, both past and current, most of the trends work towards reducing hospitals, the number of admissions, and the length of stay.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. first of all, I'm really deeply disappointed in the decision that the Department of Health has come forward with to say that it's not in the public interest. I noticed on slide 11 on page 6, where you list five questions that you consider in determining the public interest, nowhere in there is, will this hospital remain open given the state's restrictions on their number of beds? It is, over the past 30 years, healthcare and the insurance industry has went through so many different changes. And it's in the hospital's interest to try to mitigate this risk of, you know, legislative changes, industry changes, the Affordable Care Act and the impact of MNsure, the growth of Medicaid patients. It's in their interest to remain viable. So that has me deeply concerned that we don't consider the hospital's just ability to remain open. When you talked about your statement, or when you had a statement about the how your department believes that excess number of beds will lead to doctors filling them. It's like saying that excess supply will increase the demand for healthcare. With the movement towards price transparency and high deductible insurance plans, you know, I just can't believe that there would be more patients seeking more treatments if there just happens to be more beds. That would be really up to the hospital to overbuild and then sit empty, or God forbid, discount their prices in order to attract patients to their hospital. That's something that I would see would be beneficial to this, to lowering healthcare costs by having hospitals build for an increase, to increase demand, or to increase the supply. I guess one of the main points I want to make here, and Representative Liebling was touching on it, was slide 24 on page 12, which lists all of these hospitals in the region And in these green boxes, which add up to 1,152 beds that have been licensed but that hospitals haven't used, they haven't filled them. So somewhere in the past 20 years or since you've been authorizing these beds, you have said that there is a public need for these beds, that you've authorized them to some hospital at some point. Is that not correct?
No. Mr. Gildemeister, I think a little review of sort of what Representative Liebling talked about, how the beds were frozen in time, I think might be the most succinct.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, so I should be clear in saying we as an agency have never had a job to assess whether the licensed beds that are not being used at these other hospitals are in the public interest. They are a leftover from the decision when the legislature put a moratorium in place saying there is no ability to add licensed beds to existing capacity or to create a new license, and later on they said without an exception being granted by the legislature. So these beds are just a remnant of past consolidation in the healthcare system. We've never been asked to assess whether they should exist and in what form they should exist.
And
Representative Munson.
And Madam Chair, so United Hospital that has 188 beds, they could build these beds without legislative approval. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, that's right. So sort of the inequity that I think we have referred to as well as regions is that some hospitals sit on beds that they could use unproductively or less efficiently without public scrutiny. That is sort of one of the inequities of unintended consequences of the moratorium.
Okay. But in the consideration of whether or not an additional number of beds for Regents Hospital is in the public interest, you've taken into consideration the 1,152 possible beds that could be opened at other hospitals. Is that not correct?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, yes, we have.
Okay. So this is my concern, is just because the University of Minnesota has the ability to add 935 beds and has chosen not to, you've taken into consideration that this would be allowed in this region and would not be detrimental to public interest.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have a very specific task, and to your earlier comment about shouldn't regions have an interest to remain viable, that's not the question we are asked under the statute. I mean, we are really just asked to consider not the business need but the public interest looking at the system overall. Maybe that's not fair. Maybe there are other policy scenarios that we ought to be looking at, but the legislature has asked us to look at just this specific set of questions.
Okay.
To the second point that you were raising about excess capacity, yes, we're asking ourselves, would the region's proposal in its current form add more beds to a system that already has beds, surge capacity essentially in existence? We're not asking, is that fair to regions, or does that constrain regions' ability to grow, because that's not the question we've been asked to do. So we are, uncreative bureaucrats who follow exactly the question that you've asked us to do, but we've tried to not extend our authority.
Okay. And just one follow-up question. I understand that the decision is either to say it's in the public interest or not in the public interest, but I've done large decisions for corporations before where we come up with a big analysis and then kind of works on a number, like on a scale of 1 to 100, with 100 being in the public interest and 0 being not in the public interest, where in the scale was the decision? Is it close to being in the public interest, or is it absolutely not?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Munson, I think we've tried to stress throughout the discussion that the question before us was the full 100-bed proposal. And on that measure, the full 100-bed proposal over the extended time frame, we felt that the analysis was fairly straightforward, that what we know about trends in hospitalization did not support that level of additional capacity. But we were quite careful to say That was not intended to be a comment on the lack of public interest in adding capacity at all. So it really that the answer to your question is we feel that, this was a an appropriate analysis for the full totality of the project.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Munson, in the those green boxes, we can't compel those beds to be built. We can only stop people who only have blue box capacity. And yet, Mr. Gildemeister has to give us a report as though those green boxes were fully available to patients, even if they're not fully available to patients. So this is a very awkward sort of tool that we are having to deal with here. So Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a few questions very quickly. And maybe I'll just spit them out all at once, and you can take them as in the order that you wish. But I'm curious if the department has data on any current public need for beds, if there's been any kind of analysis and see how we're filling that need, if we're responding to need versus dollars. And I think that Regions made a real case for the fact that the way that we pay for healthcare makes this a very complicated equation on both sides. And do the investments in technology that you mentioned that drive up cost and drive up the ability for certain services within hospitals, is there data that say that they improve outcome as well as service? And then finally, on a different note, you've mentioned that there is some concern in your analysis about the steering of patients from other hospitals into Regions Hospital. And did you look at a certain geographical area that would impact? And those are my questions, Madam Chair.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Halverson, to your question about current public need, so it's part of the we're asking that question as part of our public interest review. Would the proposal address an existing need in the community? And there we're really looking at the community at large and recognize, yes, there may be a modest increase in demand, but can the system absorb it with existing capacity? So to the extent that was part of the questions we are asking. If your question is broader about what do we know, what do we collectively know about the need for inpatient services at the service line level across the state, we have not looked at it. And I think as part of our finding, we diplomatically, I think, suggest this is something worth knowing about. So we clearly have seen a reorganization in obstetric care across the state that may have created a need that is really difficult to serve. We haven't looked at that. Same is true for mental health. The same may be true for outpatient services like obtaining radiation therapy for cancer patients. Geography matters in that. But the short answer to your question is, for the proposal specifically, we looked at it, but there are many, many unanswered questions around the question about access and need. To your third question, to your second question, technology, I think the answer is it depends really on the technology. I mean, technology can be immensely productive in a sense that it really reduces the need for input and produces better outputs, including outcomes. But that's not guaranteed, and it's not always the case, and it's probably less the case when the competition is about, speaking to what patients are attracted by rather than focused on delivering the best, highest quality care that is most cost efficient. So I would say it really depends, and I'm sorry that it's not a more definitive answer. I did note down your question about steering, but it no longer makes sense to me. So you were asking, would you mind repeating it?
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I hope my question makes sense. you had mentioned that there is a concern in your analysis about the steering of patients to Regions from other hospitals. I was wondering what, how large of a geographic area that impacts in Minnesota.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, and my apologies to Representative Hobson, your question always made sense. Just my notes didn't make any sense, nor can I read my own handwriting, I suppose. For the analysis, we looked at the East Metro area, and I should maybe qualify what I've said earlier. What we looked at was the existence of narrow network that we at that point defined at hospitals, at networks that only permit access to one hospital in the East Metro area, or primarily in St. Paul. So yes, the networks would have included hospitals in Minneapolis to access, but in terms of thinking about the three hospitals in the East Metro area, there's a trend that makes economic sense to sort of say we restrict networks in certain areas so long as they permit appropriate access to services, because that generates the ability to manage care better, because that allows the negotiation of discounts resulting from predictable patient volume, et cetera. So we're not saying that this doesn't make economic sense. We're just saying it may have the consequence of a shift of market share among hospitals.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think maybe you could answer the question. You know, we've talked a few times about, you know, the vertical integration, the possibility of steering the market forces that we need to be careful about. And there was one of the statements that you used in support of, you know, that concern, Regents Hospital took great exception to. The two-thirds of health partners networks restrict patients to Regents Hospital alone. You know, I'd actually just be interested in, you know, where that statement came from, since it's been called into question, and whether you, you know, is there a mistake behind that, or is that something that you...
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, so thank you for that question, and for the that gives me the ability to clarify what I said earlier. So number one, I think vertical integration makes fine economic sense, I would be surprised if vertically integrated healthcare wouldn't look for a way to take advantage of that structure. So steering is not a dirty word in this case, but it does have implications. We believe in the context of driving patients between hospitals. Our analysis was focused on the question, do patients in the East Metro area have access to more than one of the East Metro hospital? And what we found from, yes, a subset of a small group and individual market health plans, was that two-thirds of the health partners' policies in that market space in St. Paul provided access only to Regions. Again, it's not we're not commenting on the merits of that. We're just commenting on the dynamic where overall market share of the health plan health partners and the integration with the hospital Regions, the drive towards narrowing networks creates the potential to steer patients to Regents Hospital. I think it's a logical chain of events for us. And I should say there isn't a ton of good data on this, unfortunately. We are basing our analysis on just the individual and small group market, but the dynamics that lead to the construct of more narrow networks is driven by the trends in the underlying cost of care. So the pressure to create networks, whether you want to call them narrowed or favorable or high-value networks, the pressure is experienced in the fully insured market as well as in the self-insured market. So that dynamic will continue. We don't have great data to demonstrate it.
Thank you. And Senator Lurie, any further questions? Okay. Members, seeing no one else on the list, I'm going to ask, it says Senator Schumacher, but I imagine Representative Schumacher. He has a few questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Commissioner and to Mr. Gildemeister, in the last couple of weeks, of course, as we moved through this process and the bill sits on the floor, more of our members have been reaching out to me with concerns that they're hearing from their local hospitals about what impact this may have to their local hospitals. The red flag that popped up with me, or the concern or the question that came up in my head, is that the members who are coming to me with these concerns that they've heard from their hospitals about this proposal, the hospitals are anywhere between 3.5 to 5 hours away from the metropolitan area. And I know that your analysis only dealt with the East Metro piece, but could you comment about kind of some of the basic considerations with this and what kind of concerns there may be, just how high level those concerns should be for hospitals that are even, you know, more than 2 hours away from the metro area with this, and just your general analysis from that.
Mr. Gildemeister, start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, we've focused our analysis on patient in the primary service area, which is focused on the East Metro, as well as patients from Wisconsin, primarily because that was the population that the region's proposal was calibrated around, and primarily too, because that is where most of region's business is coming from. So we didn't ask the question how would other hospitals be affected by it. Maybe we should have, and maybe we could have done it if you had allowed us the full 3 months to conduct the review. We, of course, have time to think about that. So I can't address the question really based on any empirical evidence that we've done, but I think it's fair to say the game today is referral networks. How do you manage flow of patients to create a most efficient balance between expensive capacity at a tertiary hospital, expert staffing, and sufficient patient flow. So clearly, this is one of the tensions I think that we're observing between access and the cost of care, where I think there will be a concentration of high technology services in metro areas because that seems to make sense. Will that impact, does that have the potential to impact smaller hospitals? I think that's quite possible, and we've seen that with regard to the obstetric discussion. How to resolve that, I think, is really a question of finding a balance between, or looking whether we're interested in finding a balance between planning, between controlling costs, between letting the system build to its build itself around the most efficient business case for delivering these kind of services.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I just would take this opportunity to thank the committee members for your really thoughtful questions. I think the kinds of questions you've asked illustrate the complexity of this topic and the related issues. And Mr. Chairman, raising the question of rural healthcare capacity, I think is appreciated and timely. I think it just further underscores the need for perhaps a bigger picture look at what do we know about population need and population trends and outcomes. Harkening back to Representative Halverson's question, I think it's been an excellent idea to take a more granular look at what we know about population trends and needs and array that against what we know about available capacity and where some pressure points might be coming. We know a lot more today than we knew 10 or 20 years ago about the relationship between access and quality and and the value of concentrating certain kinds of services for quality outcomes. So I think there's just a lot to this conversation that, to me, speaks to the need to be responsive to short-term capacity needs and to have a more robust conversation about how we even think about better matching capacity to population needs in the future.
Thank you, Commissioner. And the last layer and piece that I'll throw into this whole discussion on this is that, and to just ask the question, Regent had to pay for this report to be done or for the analysis to be done on this request, right? And then how much just was that?
Commissioner or Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we failed to invoice Regents Hospital, but my expectation at this point, but my expectation is that...
Maybe I should retract the question quick. I don't know.
The cost of delivering the analysis sort of is built up from the time our analyst team spends on it. My services come for free, or you've already paid for them in other ways. But it'll be below $30,000. Typically, it ranges around $20,000, $25,000. And when we have a final number and have invoiced regions, we're happy to share that with you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, no further questions. I just wanted to thank the department for their work and for the committee on for their attentiveness for the time that we put in for this question today. It's obviously a complicated issue, but one that hasn't been addressed of the legislature in a long time, so there's a lot more information about it. And just some questions on the overall process on how we want to move forward. I do have to say that I think Regions did a very nice job of making the case for why they are important and critical and vital to the East Metro and the types of services that are unique to what they do and for the people that they serve in the region. When I toured Regions with you, Madam Chair, they were actually taking care of a patient from my neck of the woods while we were there. It just happened on coincidence and without breaking any kind of HIPAA violations to let me know that. And I appreciated knowing that they do have a statewide impact in what they're doing. We understand that the report that we reviewed today had a lot of binary points to it. They could only answer yes or no. They could only review the proposal that was right in front of them. But I think that the department did a very nice job at laying it out so that there is room to find a process that or a solution that works and something that we can still complete this session and still have a good policy move forward with that. And that's kind of closing it. It is interesting to me that in this space, how much influence and say the competition gets to have in a request for one system to be able to expand their beds and do their business the way they see fit, how much influence the other systems that are competing with them get to have in that. And so just thank you for your chairmanship today and look forward to our work on this in the next coming weeks.
And Mr. Gildemeister, I just have a couple of questions, and for the benefit of the committee, page 11 of the slide deck and page 3 of the report under item 2, the second paragraph, we're looking at financial pressure that's being, I think it's because of a change in service mix, and specifically called out is an investment in cardiac and neurology care. So, Mr. Gildemeister, what is it that's in place that is keeping the other hospitals from investing in an advancing and more profitable mix? Is there something that Regents is doing? Is there something the legislature is doing? What is it that is causing the imbalance that you report here?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure that there are barriers in place that prevent other hospitals from making investments to attract those patients, although, I think I should leave it at that. So
Mr.
the decision...
Mr. If I could, just to follow up, because we're way over time, why is it in your report if it's something that is a level playing field here? You appear to be using it as a lever for influencing the public interest decision. And it sounds to me from your answer like this isn't the purview of the legislature,
and it is not something that we should push on because of public interest. So I'd like you to clarify why you included something that wasn't specifically related to bed count and something that all the hospitals can take advantage of to say that there isn't a public interest for Regions.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, so the proposal, the question we asked by the in the public interest review is, does the proposal have the potential to financially affect other hospitals? Sort of our chain of logic runs the following way. If Regions builds capacity that attracts more services that are more profitable, it either requires other hospitals to make investments to compete for those services, creating overcapacity or creating duplication, or it moves patients who are receiving those kind of services across metro hospitals to Regions, and there will be a financial impact. So it's the reason we're bringing it up because we see a connection between the proposal and the impact on other hospitals, which is one of the criteria that we've been asked to look at.
Mr. Gildemeister, there's nothing keeping them from competing in this space. There's nothing keeping the other hospitals from competing in this space and improving their profitability mix. Is that a correct understanding?
Madam Chair, that's correct. So hospitals could and will likely continue to compete on various levels if the proposal moves forward. One of our observations are that will create additional healthcare spending to sort of sustain duplication of services and excess capacity across all systems. But it is just focused, as you're saying, at the region's proposal, not really looking at other facilities, because again, that's the perspective you asked us to take.
Thank you. And there's a tremendous amount of work. I encourage members to dive very deeply into these documents. I appreciate that working with Representative Schumacher and you, Commissioner, and all the stakeholders. We have a hospital that today is, they're at 97% capacity right down the road. If we had a group of school students, a bus in front of the building, you know, flips over, catches fire, there's one pediatric trauma center, and today they're at 97%. So we have some serious public policy to decide. Now, in light of the public interest review, maybe 100 is not the right number, maybe 22 years isn't the right time frame, but members, I hope we consider seriously, and I hope that Regions will come forward with some guidance for us so that we know what the number is that gets them away from above 80% capacity but gives them opportunity to continue to grow and serve this area in the future. So, members, maybe 122 isn't the right answer, but we need a right answer or as close as we can get before the end of session. Representative Schumacher and I are going to work with the members of our committee to see how they want to engage this process going forward. We need people who are interested to come to us and let us know that they're interested in working on a solution. And with that, members, we are adjourned.